So you had a dream, Andrew, where your teacher...
I'm not telling you about my dreams in public, Tom. Don't tell people what my... That was a private conversation.
All right.
We have to distinguish between private and public, okay?
Why?
Because my masturbation is my own masturbation. I don't
know. I'm a firm believer in the Lynchian notion that, you know, we live in a dream. And so the idea, you know, to separate between real life and dream life is not that clear cut as we think.
I agree with that.
So because, I mean, the idea that I, or the thing that I'm thinking about a lot is, you know, this very distinction that we think, oh, you know, in dreams, most of the time it's subconscious, but, you know, in the day-to-day life, we are like kind of aware. But in reality, 80, 90, 95% of cognitive processes is unconscious in the day-to-day life. And so it's not really a big difference.
Yeah. Well, I can share that I had a dream about somebody telling me, pointing me in the direction of Ken Wilber, telling me, pay attention to Ken Wilber, you know, and I've kind of dismissed Ken Wilber in some sense. Like I haven't been paying attention to him for the past 10 years. There was a period where I paid a lot of attention to him and I read Sex, Ecology, and Spirituality. I read all his books and I read a lot of his stuff. And I remember there was this site called Integral Naked. Do you remember that?
Yeah, sure.
Integral Naked was pretty cool. I thought it was like an early version of kind of podcasting and what we do now. And and there were all kind, even Sharon Stone was on Integral Naked. You know, I remember an interview between Sharon Stone and Ken Wilber.
Oh, really? Yeah, and Julia Ormond, and that was the time with the Wachowskis, and where Wilber was, you know, interviewing the Matrix gals, I think.
Also,
you have to
say. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was kind of an interesting time.
The sexy Matrix gals, you know, I'm not talking about Carrie Ann Moss, I'm talking about the Wachowski sisters. So sexy.
Be careful about what you say, Tom. Be careful. People are very sensitive out there. Please be careful. There's a lot of sensitive people out there. You don't want to hurt their feelings.
Yeah. Again. Okay. So what we wanted to talk about, dreams. Yes.
Mm. Well, you know, and Wilber, just one more comment about Wilber. I think when Integral Naked website was around, Wilber was sexy. He was big, muscular guy. He was a sexy dude.
Yeah.
That was part of the reason why he was so popular, besides his brilliant ideas, of course, but also his, just how he appeared on screen as this sexy, muscular, all American Zen guy. You know, we underrate sexiness in terms of mass appeal and popularity often.
I mean, there's this thing that in a weird way, Wilber is, you know, kind of underrated. And I'm not talking about his theories or his models or, you know, the integral theory per se, but, you know, he provided so much arguments and so much discourse. So if you read any, let's say, meta-modern book, and even if they're explicitly excluding Wilber from the discourse, you know, you find most, like, a lot of arguments there that Wilber already did in the 90s or aughts or whatever. And I mean, it's just like, I'm working with the book now, The Religion of Tomorrow. It's a little bit redundant, but it's still a great book. He's a great writer. The insights when he talks about the higher stages and states of consciousness, that's, you know, that's not that's something that he copied from some religious people. You feel that he's describing those things out of personal experience.
Yeah.
And super weird, you know, to have somebody that's not just like an intellectual that well-versed, but also that deep in a kind of sense.
And even his first book, Spectrum of Consciousness, was a beautiful little book, and he wrote it when he was 21. So he obviously had real, you know, real state mystical kind of experiences. And whereas most of these guys are just intellectuals, right? Where he did a lot of Zen, and he worked with Kalo Rinpoche and did, you know, Vajrayana practice, and he did all these practices. And he, I think he, actually succeeded at them. He accomplished them, right? Which is quite rare. And then he became an intellectual. So I think what we have now is we have a lot of people who are intellectuals, you know, mildly interested in spirituality, but they're mostly intellectuals. They don't have the, let's say the chops or the, you know, the spiritual depth really to do much more than be pop culture, you know, figures.
Yeah. I mean, the thing also is that the structure in which Wilbur presented his theory, you know, language-wise, you know, this kind of formal, operational, descriptive kind of, I'm talking about stages and quadrants. And so that, you know, allures to a lot of rational thinking people.
Yeah.
And it creates a kind of allergy against postmodernism and the green meme itself. And so that is kind of inbuilt in the Wilburian model. So and that's nothing new. And so I think what Hensi, Freinacht and you know, all these metamodern guys do, it's that's a healthy integration of the green meme. You know, you have to think politically. You know, I think that's the thing that, you know, really is being put forth, that you have like an integral perspective or like a metamodern, postmodern kind of way to really integrate, you know, the good sides of postmodernism, something that the Wilburian model itself never kind of accomplished.
Well, if you have to be political, but you have to be wise first, you know.
Right. Like,
people are very political, but they're not that wise. That's the sense I get from the metamodernist folks.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they'll be very angry at me for saying that. So I'm sorry. No, I hope I didn't hurt some feelings of some metamodernists, because they're very sensitive, the metamodernists.
Well, they can take a hit, so I don't think.
I'm teasing. Yeah.
But, you know, Wilbur isn't very political. He is very spiritual, you know. And so what resonates with me at the moment is, you know, again, dream work, because I don't know. It's like in waves, like as in waves, Wilbur comes back into my life and I read something, and then you read it. You don't read it for 4 years or 3 years or whatever. And then it comes back. And so the same thing goes with dream work. And I don't know how your dream work is. But, you know, it's like for me, you know, this kind of working with lucid dreams that comes and goes. And then there are these phases where I'm just, you know, a mess in my head and I'm not very conscious in my dreams. But then when these waves come back, I started to become more lucid and more, you know, able to be aware of that I'm dreaming and shape my dreams. Have you ever had experience lucid dream wise?
I wouldn't say I'm very good at it, but there's the dream yoga component to the practices I do.
So what is it, I don't know if that's private, but what is dream yoga like from a Buddhist standpoint?
Well, you're supposed to notice that you're dreaming while you're dreaming.
Well, that's lucid
dreaming.
That's
the essence. But then, and then there's also There's the practices where you fall into sleep as you're contemplating a certain syllable or image and then you try to pay attention to the moment between when you actually fall asleep, this liminal moment between sleeping and waking, and then you know, if you're good at it, you can actually practice in your dreams, which I'm not. Some people can sort of, and if you're practicing in your dreams, you're working directly on the unconscious mind. So the practice is far more powerful than when you do it in the state when you're awake, because when you're awake, you have the conscious mind as a sort of profound filter.
Yeah.
I think that's what I could say about it. But there's something, you know, I know that on the higher level, spiritual teachers like Krishnamurti kind of dismiss dream work as kind of like, you know, forget that, just go for the non-dual state. And I kind of agree that's not very wise. I think dream work is useful and important. And I've noticed that when I'm doing in coaching, for example, if I'm working with somebody and they have a dream, it adds a whole dimension to what can be explored. You know, it has it. A dream is like this language that's speaking to you and is saying things, and deciphering that can be very revelatory from my perspective. And me and my wife are always analyzing each other's dreams. I think that's like, if you can't do that, then I think there's something wrong with the culture that where you don't wake up in the morning and say, what did you dream last night? And then you have a conversation about it, you know, with your partner. I think that's just the most natural thing in the world, because it's like, what is the night? What is the world trying to say to me?
Yeah, but that itself is a Freudian approach, you know, which is valid, of course, you know, dream interpretation, mm-hmm. stuff
association
like that. What Wilbur's argument is that, you know, the exposition and the work with the subtle realm gives you so much insight into the mechanics, let's say, of psyche and consciousness, yeah. and this whole area, that without that, the realization of the causal and the non-dual mind will never be complete. That has nothing really to do with, mm-hmm. you know, with interpretation, or not so much, but more like to understand, you know, how psyche itself, let's say, is working. Right. Mm-hmm. And so what really is the difference between, you know, waking mind and dream mind? And, you know, I think it's like two drawers that you can open and put your thing in. But I suspect that in reality, the difference is not that much.
Well, I've heard yogis say that they don't know the difference, that there is no difference. At a certain point in meditation, there's no difference, that they can actually keep awareness through the dream state. So there are people who, you know, can do that. That's one stage of you know, practice. You know, if you're doing these, just if you're doing deep meditation, one stage is where you lose the boundary between dreaming and sleeping, which is probably pretty hard for most people to understand. I don't quite understand it.
So what I do at the moment, because I'm always fascinated by these things, to, you know, to use meditation in a hermetic kind of way. So because you have all these, you know, the subtle archetypes, right? Mm-hmm. You know, which we normally, or, you know, in the mythic kind of stage of consciousness, you would call them ghosts or gods or demons or whatever. And so, but they're like parts of your architectonal substructure of consciousness, of the subtle realm. And so what I do is to work with Morpheus, you know, the god, the Greek god of sleep and dream, you know, to mm-hmm. access these kinds of, to bring them into consciousness and to submerge, you know, waking consciousness with these kinds of energies and structures and intensities to get a to create more awareness within dreams. And the weird thing is that these kind of things still work. That's the interesting thing, you know.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, so, I guess, you know, in my own tradition, there's different. We work with deity,
right?
Deities are yidams, and there's a certain, each yidam has a kind of a different quality.
Right.
But and you work with them, and you kind of, you merge your mind with, you know, image, sound, and, you know, the sonic and image, and, you know, mantras or whatever.
Right.
You merge your mind with all these things, and there's a transformative process that goes on where your perception becomes deity, right? So it's like ordinary perception. In Vajrayana tantric Vajrayana, you're supposed to go beyond ordinary perception to the point where nothing is ordinary. So so perception itself becomes deity. You know, and that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, that's interesting. Mm-hmm.
So the perception is the deity, and I think, and then the shunyata is the emptiness out of which the perception arises. But so you can, you know.
Yeah, but I mean,
then they don't have that, or you know, a lot of religions, they don't really believe in the anthropomorphizing things. They find that heretical or something. But the cool thing about Vajrayana is it uses all these things, but the philosophy is that you know, they're not ultimately real. But also, this is not ultimately real either, so it gets a little tricky.
No, but I mean, it's not just Buddhism or, you know, Hermeticism. You have the idea of, let's say, Marduk, this old ancient god who has this crown of eyes, and he is the personification of consciousness itself, the deification of consciousness itself. That was consciousness was described as Marduk, as the god Marduk. You know, and so you have, you know, these weird different perspectives that you can have on consciousness and mind and psyche.
But do people still worship Marduk? I don't think so. There's still people who worship Vajrayogini, but there's not very many people who, I think those gods have become, you know, are no longer, they might be in operation, but I don't think they're in operation in the same way.
No, they're not.
There has to be a practice. There has to be people practicing.
They're part of your collective unconscious, and therefore you can still access them. You know, it's like you can still, if you do the right ritual, the right practice, you can still confine with Morpheus or with Dionysos or with Mercurius, or like all these kind of different god structures represent different parts of your architectonal upbringing and bootstrapping of consciousness and reality of themselves. And that's the interesting thing. You know, you don't, it's like you don't have to view them as independent entities anymore, because that would be like a mythic kind of pre-modern way of looking at these things. But if you look at them like you know, ancient, psychological attractors that are necessary to boot itself up, then you have a way to access these kinds of attractors and vortexes. And you know, that's what you do with tarot. You know, if you have a tarot card, you don't believe that the images and symbols and gods that are depicted are real. No, they represent something within your own psyche.
It's not that. It's very tricky. It's a tricky business, I would say.
Now, hopefully.
It's an extremely,
would be shit if it would be easy.
It's extremely tricky business because you could create all kinds of fantasies about all kinds of things, right? So are you creating a fantasy about some god, or are you actually accessing something that is in operation? In the subtle realm, or are you just inventing something, or inventing some kind of fantasy about it?
So that's really interesting, because talking about Wilbur, so what he says, what evolution in the cognitive realm is all about, I forget this word. Let me look at this word. So I get that right. So you have so what happens is you create groves or gorge or furrows, you know. So there are these things that, you know, get how does he phrase it? So by repetition, you create habits of the mind and habits of the universe, right?
Yeah, it's all habits.
Yeah, and so if you create, for if you access, for example, Morpheus, you access that crevice, that habits of that Greek god, and then, I mean, it's subjective, but if your personal reality changes after that, that is, you becoming more aware or even lucid in your dreams, then it's not fantasy anymore. I mean, it's still fantasy, but it's fantasy in a way that is scientific, because you can say, oh no, actually through the practice, through the ritual, I became more aware in dreams. You know, so it's existential. It's not, it's real.
But where do you get the ritual? That's the thing. Like for me, if I would be doing a deity practice, I would get that from a lineage.
Right.
That would, you know, and undo a certain empowerment, and then I would be empowered to practice that deity. But I'm worried about the do-it-yourself kind of thing in the occult world, where people just, you know,
there's no do it yourself in the occult world.
Yeah, no, there can't be, right? You have to.
Yeah, but that can be everywhere. But if you follow a practice, and even if the occult hermetic practice, there is a, like a very specific way you do it. You can't just do it
exactly. Yeah. So that's where we're agreed. Yeah.
Yeah,
because you could just have a fantasy about Morpheus and make your own ritual, and then you have your own religion of one person. That to me would be somewhat suspicious. It's a bit like a lot of people are trying to worship, you know, Loki and like these old Norse gods at the moment. It's this neo-paganism, and maybe something's real in that. But I also, you know, I think that. Also, do you want to evoke those gods again? Because those gods are part of a very old, violent culture.
Right.
Do you want to evoke those energies? Isn't that a bit what, you know, what the Nazis did or something like that? So you have to be careful which
what you wish for, yes.
Which entities that you are invoking.
No.
If you're, so there's the fantasy, but also what if you're invoking this very dangerous entity and it causes havoc on people?
If you want to invoke, let's say, Odin, you have to be able to handle it. And it's just, and there's like a different kind of, and I think what you're addressing is very, very important, because, I mean, you can have the self fantasy that you're invoking Odin, and that maybe you get like a little taste of it, but Odin is a strong force of the universe. And so the question is if you can handle it. And again, I think,
what's still, more than that, it's the question is, Odin, like, because the gods are not necessarily benevolent, right? Is Odin?
That's what I mean. Yeah, but again,
you might be invoking a tyrant. You might be invoking another Hitler. You know, you might be invoking.
Well, you're not invoking Hitler when you're invoking Odin. So, but I guess I know what you're saying. Mm-hmm.
You're invoking a pagan god, which is a gods that believe in sacrifice and you know, and war and.
Yes, but what I mean to say is, let's stay with Morpheus. If you invoke Morpheus, so the result should be, you know, the scientific, let's call it the scientific result, that you get access to that part of the substructure of your psyche in a way that you are more lucid, or that you became lucid in your dreams. That's such a proof. Mm-hmm. The proof is in the pudding. The proof is in the pudding in that kind of sense, right? So you can really see, oh no, that's that I, even if the ritual is made up, if the result is verifiable, then the thing works. Because you can also like follow a lineage or follow a proper ritual and it doesn't work. So the proof is always in the pudding. The same goes for Odin. So if you access that deep part of the architecture of your psyche, which is, I would guess, I mean, Odin would be like Zeus, the mimetic structure of the father of all fathers. So that thing, what makes every father, right? And that is mm-hmm. such a you know, primordial energy, and that will shape your reality. If you really access that energy, that will shape your reality in ways that normal consciousness can't even handle.
Yeah, so the gods are real, yeah. Basically.
Yeah, well, the substructures of the psyche are real, yes. Mm-hmm. I don't believe in gods. I believe in psychological attractors.
But that's still merely no. You're merely psychologizing. Why would the psychological substructure? Why would it be any more real than the actual? Like, they're both unreal. Like I mean, this is how it was taught. It's like, is your hand any more real than Bajrogini?
Staying with Wilbur,
or do you just have a psychosomatic, or do you just have a psychosomatic image of that and that you believe to be real, and actually really reality is something else entirely altogether.
Okay, so let me make a case. So you have, like, let's call it a quality, right? And we don't mm-hmm. want to specify that quality, and then you have, let's say, a pre-modern traditional conscious stage of consciousness, like Christian or Buddhist or whatever. And then you approach mm-hmm. this quality and say, oh, that's a god. That's external, right? And then mm-hmm. and then you go about it and you say, you're becoming orange, you become modern, you become postmodern, and then you start to integrate this quality. You don't know still what it is, but you can say, oh, maybe that's more part of consciousness and psyche itself. And then if you go in the terms of Wilbur, you go more into the second tier, third tier stages, you can think of these qualities as being, as well as you can think of, oh, okay, these might be qualities and these are co-enacting. These are like kind of strange things that are between me and the cosmos, but they're not gods. They're like, that's something in between. They're co-enacting and they're creating, they are in creating consciousness and cosmos itself. It's a weird way to, you know, approach that with language. But do you get what I'm saying?
No. Because, not fully. Okay. It's like you say, you have to make it scientific, and I'd say that no. Science is an entirely different realm.
No, that's not what I'm saying.
Spirituality. They're not in the same realm.
That's not what I'm saying.
Okay.
I'm saying, then dependently on your stage of consciousness, you will understand these phenomena in a different kind of way. So if you're pre-modern, you will understand these phenomena as gods. If you're modern or post-modern, you will understand these phenomena as part of the psychological substructure. If you're integral, teal, or violet, or whatever, you will understand them as co-enacting phenomena that appear dependent on what your frame of mind is.
Okay. So these three different lenses through which to view the same phenomenon. Yeah, I sort of disagree with that, but I kind of have an aversion to the psychologizing of such experience that's a reduction again. It's another kind of reductionism to say.
But isn't it to say it's a god is also a reduction? That's the whole point of first.
Yeah. Well, also, yeah, reifying it in some kind of a way is a reduction. Psychologicalizing it in some kind of a way is a reduction as well.
But
so,
I don't think it's
those two things. I think that's, you're either falling on the side of materialism or eternalism, right?
Right.
You know,
but if you take
materialism
it,
as like reifying something and making it an absolute, psychologizing it is saying, oh, it's just mind, and it's, you know, you're reducing it.
Yeah, but if you go about it third tier wise, then you have it. You can leave it as this unspecified phenomena that you can observe depending on your stage of consciousness, right? And so it's like this weird thing. Is it a god? Is it an entity? Is it a substructure? Yes, all of this at the same time and nothing of it. And that's the interesting thing.
That's closer to what I think is right. Yeah.
So
that makes better sense.
And so that's more like in a Wilberian sense, like a more accurate, because like, what is everything? You don't know what everything is because the isness of things, you know, that we say, this is a waterfall, this is a ghost, all this isness kind of business that falls away. And so you have the complexity to deal with the phenomena in a more fluid way. And that's the interesting thing.
Yeah, well, I was thinking about James Lindsay and his aversion to mysticism, and that kind of aversion and where that comes from. I think maybe that's staying at what you're calling the second tier, in the merely psychological, philosophical, materialist perspective. If you have only that perspective, then all this stuff is just fucking bullshit, right? And that's so.
First tier. Mm-hmm.
James Lindsay is on this sort of rampage, saying mysticism is evil, Gnosticism is evil. Stay away from that. We need sort of this, enlightenment values. What he doesn't know is that it's a nostalgic regression to an outmoded, form of being, which is it's neither like. It's actually archaic, it's like the ancient school of materialism, all these things are actually also archaic as well. So it's not just such a linear thing between stage one, two, and three. I think you could find schools of materialism, in ancient Greece, and you can find schools that merely psychologize in earlier times as well. So there's, anyway, maybe that sounds confused a bit, but you see this reaction to this kind of thing, because I
it's
think
a good,
people
it's
haven't
a good
properly
example
thought through.
That you're doing with James Lindsay, because I mean, like, in a technical sense, it's not second tier. In the Wilbur sense, it's first tier, because Lindsay is a modernist critiquing postmodernism, but he doesn't have an integral worldview that kind of acknowledged the value of all of this. And that's interesting because we talked about Peugeot as well. And in the same way that Lindsay is a literalist, Peugeot doesn't seem to me that he has, that he is a symbolist. And so he does the same thing like Lindsay, but on the other side of the spectrum, he views these symbols as something that are essential, but they're not. Right, and that's the weird thing. He doesn't.
That wouldn't
seem
be my criticism.
Let me,
is
let
my
me,
criticism?
Let me,
I'm,
let, Andrew,
go ahead.
Let me please say what I want to say. So, for me, he doesn't seem to, as somebody who has really enlightened insight into the eternal structure of these phenomena, because he only looks back into the Bible, which is symbolism at its core, and so he's not that different. He's a literalist. That's what I mean to say.
No, I talked to him and he has more of an apophatic non-dual view of God. He understands the deep mysticism. How I would critique him, and that's where he, like, you know, and I think the deeper aspects of orthodoxy do have profound, you know, understanding. But on the other hand, I think that he frames everything within a Christian context, so he can't see outside of that particular boundary. So he's actually does have a very deep mystical view, and he has a pre-modern view, but he wants to just trash all of modernity, right? He's against modernity. So he's like a René Guénon and all these traditionalists who actually were extremely deep and interesting, but they saw modernity as fundamentally evil. And that would be my criticism of Jonathan. But I think he has a big leg up on Lindsay, because at least he understands the, you know, deep structures of mystical, you know, understanding. At least he has that understanding. So I think Lindsay remains very much on the surface.
I mean, like, from a Wilberian sense, it doesn't make a difference of if you're like where you are in first tier. Either you reject modernity or you reject postmodernity. But it's like for me, it's the same thing. You know, so they're both fundamentalists. You know. So
there is a fundamentalist aspect. Yeah, that's true.
So in both of them, and so they're both not integral. They're both symbol dependent. They think their symbols represent a real thing. There's no arbitrariness in that.
Well, you have to also include symbols, don't you? I mean,
Sure.
So yeah, I mean, I guess you could take these guys and you could learn from Lindsay, sort of like, okay, here's how to make a really good, like, logical argument, you know, with all the fallacies of, you know, really, like, then this is what you can learn from the atheists, right? How to just make a good empirical logical argument, you know.
Right.
And what you can learn from Peugeot is just the depth of mysticism, you know, with Christian mysticism. It's obviously very deep, but you can also say, yeah, these views are limited.
Right.
They're limited because you're not taking in the full spectrum. So this is where I guess Wilbur's genius was, is that he said, okay, look, guys, we have to look at the full spectrum here.
Yeah.
So you can look at Christianity within a spectrum instead of saying it's the only way, or, you know, it's the only way. That's the problem, right? Lindsay is saying the only way is rational, empirical, enlightenment values, first principles, etc. And Paggio is saying the only way is that we come back to go back to Christianity.
And you need both of them, you know.
Yeah.
You need both of them. You need the a tradition, and a Christian tradition, and a tradition that is alive to show that these kind of wisdom traditions still work, you know. And you have to have experts on that, but at the same time you have to have experts on modernistic thinking that is kind of critiquing the thing that is useless in postmodernism, right? And so you need these people, you know, and they advance, you know, their thing, It's not just that.
They do, but they also have a scapegoat. I'd like it if Wilbur understood René Girard's scapegoat theory a bit, because it seems to me that what he, you know, people below what he calls second tier always have a scapegoat.
Yeah.
And for Lindsay, the scapegoat is Gnosticism and mysticism. For Pajot, the scapegoat is postmodern, you know, relativism. You know, for all these guys, and they, you know, they have a scapegoat because they have an ardent, passionate hatred of something.
Yeah.
Right? They just have to hate something. They have to hate modernity, or they have to hate religion, or they have to hate, you know, something like science. They have to have the, you know, even and Jordan Peterson has to hate the post-Marxism. He has to, it's really interesting. There's this virulent, there's always an enemy. There's always an enemy.
Yeah.
You have to have that enemy. If you don't have that enemy, the enemy gives you energy for your particular platform. But I think second tier would be, you don't have a platform, you don't have an enemy necessarily, like you see the signal and the noise, but you don't have a strict enemy. The only enemy is your own ignorance, you know, on some level, right? Like that's the most fundamental enemy.
Well, it's very interesting that you say that, because I mean, harking back to the beginning of our conversation, so there is an inbuilt In the way Wilbur describes postmodernism and, you know, second tier, there is an inbuilt allergy against first tier and postmodernism in general. And you see it in the specific phrasing that the edge of evolution is, you know, the higher you get, you know, mm-hmm. so integral, let's say, that makes everything first tier in a kind of sense the enemy, because you want to be at the edge of evolution and everything is a little bit regressive, while in fact, in reality, every stage has its edge of evolution. You need people like Peugeot and Lindsay to advance their case. That's an edge of evolution,
yeah,
as well.
They're not your enemy.
No, but if you phrase something, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, but if you phrase in a Wilberian sense, if you phrase something like second tier is the edge of evolution, then everything below that becomes kind of an enemy. And that's the allergy that Wilbur himself produced, because suddenly everything is, oh no, we want to be green. That's ugly. Then that becomes the scapegoat. Because, and that's the eternal critique that was leveled against Wilbur since the 90s, because he has this hierarchical, you know, modernistic way of describing integral, right? And so
it's very interesting. Like hierarchy becomes a scapegoat also, right?
Yeah, but
I feel like Nora Jones and all these people are really, they're allergic to hierarchy. So they don't like, I get what you're saying, but I think that genuine second tier would be like, okay, we can see Lindsay, you know, he's off a bit. We can see that, right?
That's what I mean.
About a lot of things.
That's what I mean.
But he's off. He's not an enemy. He's got some truth, but he's off. He's not, because a scapegoat is a full on enemy, right? Like if you're green, you know,
right.
you're full on, your enemy you have a full-on enemy, but at the second tier, there's no more enemy, you know, like there's no more full-on enemy. And again, I think the only enemy is your own ignorance, your own limitations, I think it becomes completely up to you at that point.
Evolution is a weird thing evolution is a weird thing because the edge of evolution is not only vertical, it's also horizontal, because you have people that advance the scientific, you know, progress. They do. And they advance the arguments on that particular stage. The same goes for Pajot. He advances, you know, the depth of the original Christian, you might even say orthodox, systems of enlightenment. And he advances that. And so, but that's more like a vertical, like a horizontal edge of evolution on that particular stage. And so like it's more like a outgoing balloon where you have the progress, you know, on every scale, on every in every direction.
It's interesting. I was listening to Rabbi Friedman talk about Kabbalah. Kabbalah was always, until 400 years ago, you couldn't study Kabbalah, you know, unless you were a man who's 40, and then we have to be in a room with one person. And it was because culture was not ready for it on a larger level, right?
Right.
So it would have to be very hidden, very secret, very, you know, very behind the Bard absolute, as Bard said. But later on, okay, later on, you can start to reveal these things, right? And then Kabbalah is now anybody can study it. It's not that the information there is dangerous. It's that the information is, you know, culture is not ready to be intimate with that kind of information yet. or something on a larger scale. So I think that, like, if you're just trying to reproduce what was going on before, you don't realize that those early truths or whatever are actually unfolding over time still, you know, early biblical truths. They're not like there was a truth and people understood back then what the truth was. They didn't. They just weren't developed enough to understand a new dimension of that truth, which is, so there's always new dimensions of quote unquote eternal truths arising.
Well, I don't know if you want to say this, but from my understanding, there will always be a Bard absolute. You know, because I mean, there's like, as in the Greek myths, there was always the carnival, and there were always, you know, the secret rites of Eleusis. Mm-hmm. And yeah, these rites, you can't talk about them. It's punishable if you talk about them. And even if you make the whole corpus of, let's say, Kabbalah, if you make that public, the Bard absolute of that is still unpenetrable because you need...
It's self-secret.
Yes. So it protects itself. And there's only itself. Like a tiny minority of people that enter, you know, the doors to the Bard, you know, that pass into the Bard absolute, because like the 95% of it, it's public knowledge, and it's public carnival, and it's public spirituality, like as we talked about so often. But there's like this tiny amount of people that enter and advance and deepened the Bard.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's still a small amount of people who are pushing the thing forward. Well, that's the funny thing about the internet, is it allows all the information to be sort of publicly available. And, you know, I can remember a time prior to that in my own, you know, when I was studying Vajrayana, you know, you have to get empowerments. You know, to do a certain practice, you need to get empowerments within behind the Bard absolute, behind in an enclosed with an actual teacher and blah, blah, blah. So I remember that I worked very hard to get this particular permission to do this particular practice, right? Which meant, you know, which meant like month long meditation and study and all this, you know, very, you know, intensive thing. And then I got the preliminary, the beginning practice, you know. So there's like, these were only the preliminary practices that I got after a lot of study, right? Only the beginning practices. And that's the way this one school did it. And then I walked into some place in Paris and there were just people giving it out for free to everybody. Yeah. And I was really shocked because, so it wasn't that the information was too much for people to handle. It's that it's the process of hiding the information and the process of being, you know, being prepared and all that now everything is on the internet. All that stuff that was secret, you can just download it somewhere. It's completely available to everybody anywhere, but nobody will get it unless they have the actual empowerment and actually do it. And so it's still a very small amount of people that will actually do those particular practices, but you do have to go through this. I agree totally. There is still a Bard absolute. It's just that the information is freely available about the Kabbalah.
So have you ever seen Being in the World, this documentary about the philosophy of Heidegger?
No.
I will send you. It's on YouTube. It's a fantastic documentary. It's like split in two halves, 90 minutes. So you have the philosophy of Heidegger and it's intercut with, you know, interviews and, you know, the analysis of five or six masters of their particular craft. So you have Manuel Molina, which is like a flamenco player. You have like a Japanese pagode carpenter and so on and so forth. And there's nothing particular spiritual about it. But they all are kind of masters of the Bard Absolute in our world. So, for example, you have like a 80-year-old woman that is like a cook in New Orleans. And so she cooked for all the presidents, and she was like a very famous Creolean cook. And so the story goes, how it is like presented in the documentary, is like the daughters always say, why don't you put all your famous recipes in a book so people can replicate it? And she was like, honey, even if I would do that, and even if I would describe
it, they wouldn't get it. You know, yeah.
They wouldn't get it because there's something else that they can't access. You know, yeah. they cite their view, they vantage point on food and nutrients and tastes, and because that's behind the Bard Absolute, that's behind that's experience, that's mastery, and the same goes for this pagode carpenter that. Who basically lives with wood and sleeps with wood, and so he knows exactly what kind of tree he has to cut down to, you know, even if he would able to describe that in a book, he has an enchantment and you know, with these kinds of materials to create this wonderful you know, Japanese pagodas. It's, you know, and that's, you don't even have to be like spiritual to point to these kind of secret knowledge of things.
Yeah, Morpheus says to Neo, you know, you can't go in the matrix. I can't tell you about the matrix. You have to experience yourself, right? So I think people have like a lot of information today, and they mistake information for mastery or wisdom, right? Information is not wisdom. Information is not mastery. Information is not understanding. It's just information, right? And,
yeah, the interesting thing, it's interesting that you bring that back, because the interesting thing when you do meditation on God forms, let's say Mercury, that's something that becomes imminent. You can pull it down and you can access it very, very easily, because it's part of, you know, being intellectual and having ideas, and all Mercury has permeated as a God form. Morpheus is an interesting thing because by definition, it's on the other side. It is what makes this matrix kind of mythology so interesting, because indeed you have to exit and enter something else to have the experience. Morpheus is by definition behind the threshold of awareness itself, and that is a very, when you do the ritual properly, it's a very weird feeling, because suddenly your sentiment, your feelings are get turned upside down, and then you enter this kind of weird space,
like a threshold space.
And because that's kind of what stands between you and the Bard Absolute. It is, Morpheus is a kind of like a kind of figure that is between you and the Bard Absolute, let's say.
Yeah, it's interesting, but the film, it's reversed, because Morpheus is the one that shows you the real, right? You're in a dream, and you meet Morpheus and you find the real, but it should be the other way around. It should be that Morpheus introduces you to the dream, right?
Yeah, but he what is that?
It's like an inverse mythology. Also, it's like the cave. It's the cave also, you know, because normally you go up through the cave and to meet the sunlight, but in the Matrix film, you go into the darkness, right? You go down, you go into the, you know, into this destroyed world, you go into the, you know, so it's almost an inversion of the Platonic myth, an inversion of the Morpheus thing. It's
like, but it still kind of works because mythology. He is like this guardian, he is this kind of warden between these two worlds, you know, and that's why it works, you know? And because the notion is that he wakes Neo up, you know, from the dream world of, you know, the Matrix to get to the real. So it still kind of works.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
Because you have to become aware of the deeper structure of your experience.
Yeah, because the real, you know, the real is the deeper structure, not just the surface. you know, the surface existence that he's living on.
Yeah.
You know, this the virtual or the.
And so for me, just to say something personal, for me, the interesting thing is as soon as I enter these kinds of, let's say, this field, this vortex, right, of Morpheus and lucid dreams, what happens is that the first threshold I have to pass is terror.
Yes.
So because it's all, and it's always accompanied for me with a kind of nightmarish quality where I become aware of my dreams, where the first step is to encounter demons and terror and all these kind of things in the Petersonian sense, you know, you enter chaos, the unstructured realm of awareness, yeah. and then all these demons come that lies and look at me, and I'm like terrified. I'm literally terrified. Just the moment I become lucid in dreams is, you know, the moment when the terror tries to get hold of me and shakes me up, and this is like this again, this threshold.
Oh, it's sort of overwhelming too, because the unconsciousness is so vast, and to wake up within that is sort of like, oh fuck, where am I?
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Because we, you know, we live in such a narrow perceptual frame most of the time.
Yeah.
And then when we get a picture of this sort of larger sort of, you know, oceanic experience. Yeah, there's everything is down there. The monsters, the, you know, everything you could possibly
But the weird thing, like to give you like a personal example. So last week I was lying in bed, I was sleeping, and then I was like, I became aware that I was lying there in sleep. And then I heard a voice and I was like turning my head. I was already lucid, but there was literally a ghost next to me in my bed. Right. And we're like kind of scaring me. And I was completely awake. I was like completely scared shitless. And I was like, oh no, hey. And that was like, it was super weird, because it was like this eerie horror element, because I was aware that I was like in my room sleeping and there was a ghost and it was real, as was my awareness was real. And it was like, oh shit. Right. And so that was like always the first step for me to, you know, and inhabit that space to feel the demons of chaos and the.
And you have to look at them too, which is terrifying.
Like, yeah, you have to look at them.
You have to look.
You at have them. To. Yeah.
Yeah. In order for it to become, let's say, not something that haunts you and tortures you, it becomes the Holy Spirit if you look at it, right?
Like what Meister Eckhart says, you know, when you they will turn out to be angels, but they appear as demons because you don't want to look at them. But in reality, they want to pull you up.
Yeah, you know? It's just a question of attention and awareness, turning your attention and awareness to what frightens you, and then it doesn't frighten you anymore because it's within your awareness. It just becomes a mysterious sort of presence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's super interesting because, I mean, again, normally, and that's what I initially meant by the fact that, you know, there's not much difference between, you know, dream state and waking state, because in both states, we are mostly unconscious. You know, we are mostly unconscious about the deep structure, the 95-99% of what's really going on. We're not aware of the demons of our psyche, you know, except you're super neurotic or psychopathic, you know, from your daily life. But then to be confronted by that in the dream space, you know, by the, oh shit, there's so much, you know, ghosts and demons and gods and structural forces that push you and pull you. That's.
Yeah. Well, my own teacher often says, you guys are all mentally ill, like all of you, like we're all mentally ill, unless we're awakened. We're just different degrees of mentally ill, right? We don't actually think we're Napoleon. You know, like the guy in the mental hospital, like we don't think we're Napoleon, but we think we're this, which is also a extremely weird limitation of who we are, you know, fundamentally, right?
It's super interesting because, like, in a Jungian and Wilburian sense, we have an archetype, a Napoleon archetype within us, because he created the habit in our collective consciousness. So that if when these people get possessed by like a substructure from them, it's not obviously they're not Napoleon themselves, but they are like kind of super attached to that collective unconscious part of what it meant to be Napoleon. That's mm-hmm. the weird thing. So like they're attached to that subtle, you know, substructure of
yeah, unconscious. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you can learn a lot from mentally people. Like either they think they're Christ or Napoleon, usually, right? So yeah. So if they're spiritual types, they probably think they're Christ, or if they're, you know, and if they're
you can talk to Sri Aurobindo if you want in a channel. That's the easiest thing to do. You know, mm-hmm. you can access these kinds of vortexes because these people created that these kinds of habits in the you know, in the collective unconscious. So they're still there, or at least their energy. They're like an ancient pre-AI avatar that you can still access.
Yeah. It's interesting. We were talking last night with Monita and Alexander and they were talking about transcendental emergence and the idea that laws actually, they're just habits.
Right.
Like there's no Platonic law of the universe. They're just, yeah. they're kind of emergent habits. I thought that was very interesting.
Wilbur 101, yeah. Mm-hmm.
To think that in that way, that's sort of Whitehead, I think. That you know, everything is sort of habit. So you can, this is why we can change. We can shift our habits.
Yeah, that's what Wilbur means with groove.
Habit field. So you replace your negative habit with virtue habit. But actually, yeah. Enlightenment is beyond all habit. In the end, like it's free, the total freedom is outside of the habitual realm. But then the practices are sort of like transforming this kind of neurotic habit into a more positive type of habit until all the habits go away.
I don't know. In the Wilbur sense, it's the opposite. It's like the transcendence and inclusion of both. So you transcend it, but you're all habits at the same time while you're transcending it. So it's not just a complete freedom of, it's an integration and a transcendence at the same time. So, you know, it's like, I mean, it's, you know, I don't even know if that conversation makes sense, but
the karmic body might remain, but it's outside, it becomes sort of outside of causation. That is, I mean, that's how the ultimate state is usually described. But anyway, why, I guess we don't know, do we?
Not yet, or already, depends on the perspective.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
So do we do our obligatory tit joke now?
Yes, what's the obligatory tit joke? I don't have one, you know. I'm growing my tits. You know, the more I work out, the bigger they get. They're kind of like man tits, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I'm doing this yoga, my tits are
growing. Integrating your femaleness by growing.
I'm integrating my tits. Yes.
Fantastic.
And then, you know, like I'm growing a vagina also.
You do?
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm working on my vagina.
You're becoming a big pussy with other words.
Yes. Yes. working on that. How about you? You're just growing your dick longer, right? You're doing some extensions, dick extensions.
Yeah, you know, I have a penis pump. Mm?
You're like that guy that they found in Pompeii or whatever with the enormous dick. Who's the god of the with the big dick? What's his name?
Indeed, there was in Pompeii where the Vesuv exploded. There's like one mummy that had his dick in his hand. So like you imagine, so you see the lava coming at you at enormous speed, and what you do is you just crank one out, you know, the last time. It's like
that'd be a way to go.
That's amazing to me.
No, but I was thinking of, I think they discovered a fresco, and it was some aristocratic guy's house, and there was a little bordello in there, and there was the god who represents fertility, and it was this god with this enormous fantastic penis. Priapus, that's the one I'm thinking. Yes. Yeah. There was an amazing fresco of Priapus and these people making love. This was like, you know, 100 years before Christ. Incredibly
Yeah.
like graphic pre-Christian porn.
Yeah, we haven't changed that much, I would say.
I know that it's just like, wow, we're still the same. We still have that everywhere.
Yeah, we like dicks and tits and asses.
We still have dick pictures everywhere, and we still we're still doing it. We're still doing this thing. We haven't really transcended anything, have we?
No. Women say, "Look at my tits." Men say, "He is my dick." That's what it is. That's the eternal game.
That's the eternal. Here's my dick. Here I am. Unless you're like me and you're trying to grow a tits and a pussy.
No, you're on an enlightened path to integrate your anima, I think, no?
Yeah, exactly.
Fantastic.